Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. We often hear from many people, as a matter of fact, when we do a wildlife show, and we get a lot of response after the fact about people, how much people enjoy the wildlife shows. I hope you enjoy those shows as well. And I hope you're ready to ask a question or just listen in. Sit back and listen in as we visit with Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist with the UW Extension and UW-Madison's Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology for a long, long time. Scott, good to see you.
It's good to be here. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. And, boy, there's a lot to talk about. This, the month of December, I thought, was so cool because it was warm. and I had to wonder how this sort of mild winter has affected our animal population, our wildlife population, deer and so forth.
Well, so far it's good news for most species.
Yeah.
You know, they've not been, the birds haven't been particularly dependent on feeders. The deer are able to move freely about the woods. It's really stalling off what I think will inevitably be some winter weather. But, you know, it's already January and you can sort of,
yeah,
the eagle cams, and people are starting to talk about the first very early signs of spring, even toward the end of January.
Yeah.
And then the sun gets higher in the sky, the days are getting longer, so it almost seems like we caught a tremendous break. But December was incredibly mild, and there were some weird things going on. On December 21st, I had active green frogs in my little pond in the backyard.
Jay!
Which, my wife was going by walking the dog. She said, "I think I saw a frog." I said, "I don't know. It's only 4 days before Christmas." And I went out, and there was a dead one. And as I fished it out of the pond, another one swam by underneath it. I said, "Holy mackerel." So it has been very unusual. And in the long run, as long as there's some snow cover to protect the amphibians and eventually some ice cover, it should be a pretty benevolent winter, which after a couple that we've had is very welcome news. It may be very good news in the north where the deer herd's been struggling to recover. So overall,
yeah,
it's pretty, okay with me. Saving on plowing, saving on heating bills, it's great.
Pat Durkin had a nice story. He always has good stories, but talking about the deer herd and the deer hunt and how everything went this year. And you saw that, of course.
I did. I mean, the season, the 2015, and you guess have to include a little bit of 16 in there because the archery season just ended, I think, on Monday, on the 3rd, Sunday. So the deer season is finally in the books. I haven't seen the final numbers that include all the archery harvest, but as of the gun deer season, which is kind of the benchmark that everybody looks at, the deer harvest was up 1%. Not a big increase, to be sure, but an increase from what had been a string of modern lows in the harvest leading up to this year. So it took a step in the right direction with this moderate winter. I think we can look for good things ahead as far as the deer herd's concerned. Some changes in the regulations didn't prove to be as challenging as some people expected. The e-registration, for example, seemed to go pretty smoothly. At least it did when I was using a laptop. I heard some people grumbling a little bit about the phone issue, mm-hmm. but they all worked through that, and I think in the long run, people will get used to it.
Yeah.
I admit to being resistant to change, and I like to go to the registration stations, but I guess I'm lucky in that regard in that where I hunt in Iowa County, the big DNR station where they're still collecting some CWD samples is just a couple miles from the farm, so we can still go there and interact with folks who are there registering deer, but we use their laptop to actually register them rather than the traditional form. So all that went pretty well. The only black mark, I guess, was that there were some hunting accidents this year, or hunting incidents, I should say. So even with a couple days to go in the season, it was already the deadliest from a hunter fatality standpoint in the last 5 years. So that's not good. But overall, it was an interesting season. And in the article you mentioned, Pat Durkin went through a really interesting assessment of, you know, license buying, who's buying the licenses, where are they coming from, those kinds of things. So if you,
cool,
want to talk about a few of those things, we can certainly go through them. And while we're on the subject, I just wanted to throw out that both for my own purposes, for general information as a person interested in the outdoors, but also as fodder for doing things like this, I just wanted to offer up a thanks on the air to some of the local outdoor writers, people like Pat Durkin, Tim Isley, Jerry Davis.
You know,
they're all good friends, and they all do just a terrific job of, digging in to a wide range of outdoor stories that provide folks like you and I with information, good information. And through their various outlets in the newspapers and outdoor news and things like that, and web access, there's a lot of good stuff.
They do a lot of really good work. So tip of the hat to Pat Durkin, Jerry Davis, Tim Isley, and everybody else who does that kind of work.
Right. There are other good folks around the state as well.
There sure are. Well, we have Dave in Wisconsin. Dave in Wisconsin Dells, I'll get to you in just a second, but you mentioned CWD, and that brought to mind that there seems to be kind of a changing of a opinion about, or maybe should I say increasing pressure to do something about CWD.
Well, it seems like from what I see or hear, looking at editorials by folks in various outdoor outlets, things in the news, or word of mouth, that people in general are becoming a little more disenchanted or agitated by the very passive approach to CWD management that was recommended back in 2012 by the Deer Czar report, the Deer Trustee report, so that with what appears to be continuing spread geographically and continuing spread in terms of increasing percentages of infected animals in the areas that have been infected for a while, and discoveries in other areas. There was one up in Oneida County at a game farm, and there have been others around the state in the past couple of years. There does seem to be a little more interest in pushing. I don't know who or what or to do what, because there are no magic bullets. It was reported fairly recently that there was a lot of hope, for example, for a vaccine that was being worked on up in Canada, and that fell through.
It didn't pan out.
In fact, in their test groups, the ones that were treated developed CWD at a higher rate than the ones that weren't. So that didn't pan out. So no silver bullet has emerged on the horizon. So, you know, I think perhaps a little more aggressive sampling, perhaps a little more in terms of watching out for the deer that are in captivity and so forth. Maybe that's what people are interested in. I'm not sure about that part of it, but at least there seems to be a growing public interest that wasn't there a few years ago.
And you look at, well, and also you look at other states, like Illinois has done a pretty good job of keeping it intact with their management style. At least that's what I have read. Now, I may be wrong on that. But
yes, they claim that their aggressive sharpshooting program in the northern part of the state has kept their incidence rate low. You can't argue the fact that the rate is low, but whether that's because it's on the fringe of this area that has spilled over from Wisconsin, or a lower deer population to begin with, or because of their sharpshooting, or some combination of all those factors, at least what they're doing seems to be helping them out.
We have Dave in Wisconsin Dells up with a question online by phone. You can join in, too, by phone at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And if you go to our Facebook page and you have a wildlife photo you want to post, well, that'd be wonderful as well. We'll make comment on it. And now we'll go to Dave in Wisconsin Dells. Dave, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
I've got we have an acreage just outside Wisconsin Dells, but it's kind of right near where all the public hunting and fishing grounds are. And we have a stream that goes through the property. But right before we got the last snow, I was walking the dog outside before I go work. He stays inside. It's an old golden retriever. And there was a rabbit. We have a lot of rabbits, of course, that feed off of the big bird feeder we have in the back that live under the decks and stuff. But something had dragged and killed the rabbit, dragged it underneath a pine tree that's real low, so it had to be a smaller animal that did it and ate its head off. That's all it ate. So I was just wondering what animal would do something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Probably a member of the weasel family.
That's what I was going to say.
There have been
really?
Some,
yep,
they will often attack. They often kill by a bite on the back of the head and will sometimes eat the head first. And dragging it under something or essentially caching it is also typical of them, with the intent on, we've got a little stockpile there in the home freezer.
Wow.
And perhaps they go back and use it. So especially with the stream there, a mink is one possibility. But there are certainly others. Some of the smaller weasels, like a short tail, might not have been able to drag a rabbit away like that. But anyway, that would be my first guess.
Yeah.
Had it not been stashed, if it was more in an open location, then a horned owl is another possibility, too. But I'm going to guess with weasel. And, in fact, there's been a little speculation in the outdoor literature that, for whatever reason, this seems to be a really good year for weasels.
Is that right?
So if you've... you know, if you're out walking around now, in fact, last time we were up at the cabin, Larry, in Price County, we had a kind of a pile of logs and whatnot in the front yard. It was still brown. The landscape was brown, but I saw something move, and I said, hey, what's that? And it was a short-tailed weasel. He'd already changed color
to
about
ermine,
halfway
right?
to ermine color. And you know, there he was sitting on the logs, and he kept ducking in and popping out, ducking and popping out. And we got a terrific look at him. Really a cool little animal. So anyway, back to Dave's question. I think some member of the weasel family in that setting, probably most likely a mink, is the likely culprit.
There you go. Yeah. Thanks a lot, Dave.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate your call. Well, we have Mike in Algoma emailed us that he's noticed dozens of ends of branches from his spruce trees littering the ground around the trees. He says he assumes the red squirrels are doing this, but can't figure out why. As far as he can tell, they're not cutting down cones, but they do a lot of that.
Well,
on many trees.
It could be several different squirrels, but red squirrels, if he's got them, are the most likely. But
yeah,
it's pretty common for them to cut these tips, particularly on something flimsy like a Norway spruce, where they can't really hang on out at the end and dine on the cone. They just cut the branch tips. They're all over the ground, and then they come down, harvest the cones, buds, or whatever they're interested in, and then lug those away and cache them. So I would, unless it's a naive squirrel that doesn't know what it's up to, they should be harvesting something from those tips that are coming down. And the good news for Mike is that spruce tip collections, the Alaskan Brewery does a wonderful job with spruce tip beer, which is one of their winter brews. And who knows, maybe that's a home opportunity.
There you go. Oh, man. Lynn and Black Earth, your turn. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. Back to the weasels. I am just wondering how common it is to get a weasel in your house. Because that is what happened to us last weekend. All of a sudden, I looked down. It was about 6 in the morning. I was just getting ready to bring the dog out. And there was something running around on the floor. And, yeah, we're out in the country. We get mice, you know, no problem. But this thing was like a 6-inch-long mouse.
and very fast, probably.
And very fast. And, you know, of course, we were a little shocked and just more interested in getting it outside, which we finally did about an hour later. It actually eventually ran into a have a heart mouse trap that we have. We had put some sunflower seeds in it to try and catch this guy.
Hmm.
And we got it out and looked it up, and all we could really figure out was that it might be a least weasel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
A least weasel is the smallest member of the weasel family around here, and there are a lot of others ranging in size all the way up to the really big weasels like otters and wolverines and whatnot. But a least weasel is probably best described as being almost like a moving cigar, a big fat cigar. They have a relatively short tail, and usually there's no black tip on it, which is how you'd separate them from the short tails, which are also a little bigger. But anyway, they're not Was he white or brown and white?
Well, he was kind of, it looked like he was changing to, he was kind of like a gray, tawny color.
Yeah, so the one my wife and I saw was kind of a bluish gray on the back with a white belly. It was a very pretty little thing. But,
yeah.
You know, a least weasel can get into any hole that a mouse can get in.
Yeah.
And they eat mice, among other things. So my guess is it probably entered through a mouse access point, thinking, wow, I'll bet there's a lot of mice in there, and it's just as happy to be back outside. But a neat opportunity to see the animal in any event.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, yeah. How common are they?
More common than most people realize. They're around. They're just so secretive and fast that most people don't see them. And unless you get into a situation where they're either white too early in the year, which is affected by day length, but without snow cover, they're very conspicuous. Or conversely, they change in the spring and then there's late snow. They're really hard to see, but they're very curious. So if you've if you've got anything around the yard like a wood pile or some old cement blocks or something that might provide shelter, then they usually respond to squeaking. And so you can suck on the back of your hand, kind of a... That's a poor rendition, but you suck on the back of your hand a little bit, get this squeaking sound that sounds a little like a mouse in distress, or at least that's what it must sound like to a weasel, and they'll very often come out and have a look, and you at least get to see that they're around.
There you go. Thanks a lot, Lynn, for calling. Appreciate your call. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Brianne Chasseau, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, we are talking about the world of wildlife. Scott Craven, Emeritus Wildlife Professor at the UW and UW Extension, our guest. Great to have him along. Questions, call us at 800-642-1234. Or maybe you got a story you want to talk about. That's great, too. Got a photo and a question? Put it up on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Or you can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Jackie in Milwaukee has a question, so let's go there. Hi, Jackie.
Good morning, Larry.
Morning.
Question. When you see a coyote, and you know it's a coyote,
yep.
do you report them when it's in a populated area, or what do you do? Who do you call?
So you had one in Milwaukee at your home.
Walked right past my front door.
Okay.
Well, Jackie, that is really not a particularly uncommon thing, especially in that area of Wisconsin. Milwaukee County, Waukesha County have always been hotbeds of coyote activity and sightings because there's open land in close proximity to lots of people. So
and there's the creek.
Yeah, there's.
I've seen them. I've lived here for 60 years. This isn't the first time that I've seen one, but it's since all the flurry about it, I wondered if you're supposed to report them.
I don't think so. You could call the local DNR office and mention it to them, but in reality, there's little or nothing they can do. Mm-hmm. If there's some concern in the neighborhood, or if there's a neighborhood association, or you know that next door the folks have got two little toy poodles or a dachshund or something, you might just alert them to be a little cautious. But really, there's not a lot that could be done. The animal, especially if there's a creek, as you mentioned, or a greenway, or railroad corridor, or bike trail, or anything else that the animals would use as a travel lane, seeing them is not going to be that uncommon unless somebody's feeding them, which can lead to all sorts of problems, or unless they're posing, or you hear that there's been an attack on a pet, or that they seem abnormally tame. I would just chalk it up as, well, that was kind of neat to see him and not worry about it.
Yep, there we go.
It was a young male, not a kit, but a young male, and I have a large chow who was grumbling at the front door. I was waiting for a food delivery, and Charlie was grumbling at the front door, and I thought, what is the matter with you? Because he'll bark if the man comes, and all of a sudden, right smartly across the front lawn,
There he went.
So walked, and he was a, he wasn't raggy. He was a good-looking.
good-looking coyote. Oh, man. Well, Jackie, a great experience, actually. Keep the dog inside as much as you can, and be on the lookout. Have your camera ready. Get some photos of this. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it very much. And we've got many callers online, so I want to go back to the phones, and Tony and Appleton up next. Tony, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Scott and Larry. Thanks for having me on.
Sure thing.
I've spent a lot of time outdoors, and I saw something just this past fall that I've never seen before, and I have a question. I was driving in the UP in the fall, and ahead of me a crow was flying at about treetop level, like you commonly see, and he started doing what looked like half barrel rolls, where mm-hmm. he would flap five or six times, tuck his wings behind him, and do a complete turn in the air, so he was basically on his back but still flying. And coast for a bit and then flip back over, then flap a few more times to gain some altitude and do another half barrel roll. And I'm wondering if they were just having, if he was just having fun or if there's some explanation for that.
Hmm.
Well, Tony, there might be an excellent explanation for it, but I don't know what it is.
I don't either. I've never heard of that.
You know, I've watched crows and ravens. They're very acrobatic. Excellent flyers. Sometimes you see that kind of thing in association with a couple things. Harassment by other birds. If it was far enough away that perhaps there was a small bird after it, as they sometimes do, that you couldn't have seen, that's a possibility. During the breeding season, there are all sorts of displays and flights that different types of birds, from crows to eagles and all sorts of other things in between, exhibit, but it's the wrong time of year for that. And then there's always the possibility that the crow is just having a good time doing a little exhibition flying for whatever reason motivated it. That's
sure, and
go ahead.
Well, I know them to be very intelligent birds, and I guess I'd like to believe that he was just having fun. It was sure cool to see, though. I've never seen anything like it, and I have seen other displays like you've described, whether it be eagles or whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just really, really fun to sit behind him for a little bit and watch him flying ahead of me doing barrel rolls. So just wanted to share the story. So.
Thank you very much. And it's yet another reason why wildlife observation is such a popular thing.
Yeah,
From your bird feeder in the backyard to traveling out to a big national park to watch wildlife, it attracts a lot of public attention.
Yeah,
it does. Well, thanks, guys. Have a great day.
Yep, you too, Tony. Thank you for calling. Wendy in Duluth, Minnesota, up next. Hi, Wendy.
You guys have me laughing so hard as I drive and remember a story that I have to share. About several years ago, my husband and I rented a fully furnished home up in Lutzen on the shore. And it was fabulously furnished with, this woman was very creative. She had stuffed bunnies hanging from the ceiling. She had bunnies on the couch. She had all sorts of animals scattered throughout the house that were homemade. We arrived one Friday afternoon and walked into the house to find all of these animals, whether they had been hanging from the ceiling or on the couch or a knitted basket of eggs. Everything had been vandalized. And, of course, we were very concerned. And even the duck, the ceramic duck on top of the refrigerator, his head was gone.
Hmm.
And I walked upstairs to see a weasel tear across the bathroom floor and run into the closet. Don't you know, he killed every stuffed animal in that house. Every natural thing that was, or you know, every piece of craft that had an animal resemblance, he tore apart.
I'm guessing that weasel probably had to seek counseling after that. He was probably one frustrated weasel.
They are amazing little things, but that just shows you how intelligent, or maybe not intelligent.
Persistent.
Take care of your stuffed animals, folks.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Wendy. Oh, that's another great story. I have to tell you, this is always fun to do this show. There's so many great stories out there when we talk about wildlife. Steve in Madison has something for us, too. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Good morning. I hate to follow that stuffed animal story. I have a question. My daughter and her husband just bought a house in Milwaukee, actually Shorewood, just north of the city limit. And they went over to the house to get things started, and they found the remnants of, they think, five rabbits in their backyard. A lot of fur, a lot of blood, and they counted tails. What could possibly kill five rabbits at one time?
Oh, so many.
It's not a neighbor.
So many possibilities.
Yeah.
Rabbits. For better, for worse for them, better from the standpoint of explaining, are at the bottom of the heap. Everybody loves rabbits in terms of anything that's carnivorous, starting with the weasels we've been talking about and then working all the way up through fox, coyotes,
people,
a variety of raptors, people, dogs, cats, and a whole host of other things. So in the absence of, you know, some other evidence like tracks or a little history in the area, which they may get after they live there for a while, that is very difficult to say. But with that number of animals, they may not have all been killed at the same time. But if the house had been empty and there was a big yard or whatnot, it was probably the local hunting ground for who knows what. But with that number of animals, I'd be more inclined to think of coyote, fox,
yeah,
okay,
hawk, something like that. There wasn't much left of the rabbits around then.
No, basically the tails.
Yeah,
and
so
fur.
So a little bit of fur and whatnot may have been left behind by a raptor, the carcass hauled away. Usually a fox or a coyote would remove the carcass to their den. But rabbits are not very tough animals. Their hide is very thin. They don't hold together very well. You know, a few parts left around, there are a lot of animals that could have hauled them away.
Yep.
Okay. If I may, when we're the weasel in the house reminded me, do I have a moment?
Sure.
Sure.
Okay. It's about, it was about 15 years ago, we bought a Christmas tree. We live in Madison in the city, and kept the tree outside for a few weeks. Then we brought it in, let it fall, and the next day we're having dinner, and we noticed a flying squirrel sitting on our counter eating dog food. And I'd never seen a flying squirrel before. And unfortunately, this is before phones had cameras, so we never got a picture of it.
Well, you have it in your mind's eye, and they're beautiful little animals. You never know what's going to come in with the Christmas tree. One other thing, Steve, before you go, is your daughter now living in the house?
No, not yet. They're going to move next week.
Okay, so my suggestion is if they're curious about what's going on there, whether it's the rabbits or just want to see, hey, what's around, my suggestion would be buy a trail camera, one of these wildlife cameras. They're everywhere now. They're not particularly expensive anymore for the entry-level cameras. And pick a spot in the backyard on a deck post or a tree where you have a good view of the backyard and set that camera up, and they can just find out by looking. I think they'll be surprised at what's probably using that backyard at night. And it'll be interesting for them, a way to get a way to kind of welcome them to the neighborhood. They may see some things they don't want to see. I don't know. But one way or the other, it will capture a surprising number of images, and they'll have a better idea of what's going on and who's living there.
Well, they're just hoping it's not some strange neighbor.
No.
Well, we'll hope for the best.
We'll hope for the best. You know, I was thinking about the Florida couple that had, they're living in Florida, and strange sounds they would hear from time to time. And they had apparently a 20-foot long python living under the house, and apparently, eating and then going out and eating and then coming back. Fortunately, we won't have. I don't think climate change will bring about 20-foot long pythons coming to our underneath our homes or underneath our. Our decks.
Not for a long time, anyway.
Not for a long time. Dick and Viola, it's your turn. Hi, Dick. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. Last week when I was blowing snow, I had a raccoon follow me up the driveway right behind me. And then I got out of the way, and it went up and licked my running snowblower. What was wrong with it?
Ooh.
Well, maybe nothing. I mean, there are a couple of possibilities here. The ones that cause a little bit of concern is that a raccoon out during the daylight at any time is a suspect raccoon, and by suspect I mean potentially sick.
Right.
And there are a number of things that affect them. I haven't heard much about it the last few years, but some years canine distemper is a real problem in raccoons. Rabies is another problem. There are probably others, but none of them are good, either for you or pets or what have you. But any of those diseases tend to cause abnormal behavior in the animals, and following somebody with a running snowblower and then licking it, I would describe as abnormal raccoon behavior. So that would be the first thing that I'd be suspicious of, but there's always the outside possibility that the animal was out for whatever reason. What time of day were you out? Early in the morning?
Mid-morning.
Well, so, I mean, the animal could have been out foraging. Depending on when the storm hit, it ended up in the wrong place, hunkered down for a while. It was just trying to get back to its den under your deck or who knows where. And, hey, here's a path somebody's clearing for me. The contact with the snowblower is a little strange, particularly with it running. And so what did it do after? Where did it go?
Well, I sent it to meet its maker.
Oh, okay.
And then I put it out in the field for the eagles to eat.
I see. Well, okay. Well, problem solved, I guess, in some ways. So we'll never know for sure, but you disposed of it. So I guess that's the plus side of it. But disease is a possibility. The other, is this a neighborhood kind of area or rural area?
No, this is rural.
Okay, then the third explanation that, hey, this was a raccoon that someone had really tamed down by feeding or raising it or whatever, and all of a sudden it wasn't concerned about you is less likely. But yeah. I guess you dealt with it, so end of story.
And the eagles are probably okay.
Probably fine.
Thanks, Dick. Thanks for calling. We have more callers online. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions or comments. You can also go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show and post there as well. Let's go to Mike in La Crosse next. Hi, Mike.
Hello. Yeah, this is what I called it to tell you about. The reason I'm able to see this is because I'm a locomotive engineer, and I run pretty much up and down the Mississippi River from La Crosse up to the Twin Cities and all the way down to Galesburg, Illinois. And what we see regularly, especially in the warmer part of the year when there's leaves on the trees, is the eagles will gather in the higher trees, and some places will have trees on either side of the track right off the river. And they'll be perched up there in the trees, but then as the locomotive approaches, and this is when we have to be at a higher speed so that we generate a pretty good slipstream, they'll dive off of the trees right practically in front of the locomotive as we're approaching at a high rate of speed, and they'll catch that slipstream, and they'll do an entire 360-degree flip in the air and shoot out the opposite side of the track bed and then climb altitude.
Wow. Well, that lends some support to our theory that the crow is just having a good time up in the UP.
Right.
Oh, that is.
Two other things about eagles is, and then, well, the other thing is that they seem to have caught on now the past couple of years with all the construction on along the tracks, and we've been going a lot slower. You would see at times where they were, a bunch of them were perched up waiting to do this, and then when they drop down in front of us, and we weren't going that quick. And there wasn't that much of a force of air in front of the locomotive. And while there was nothing for them to catch, they had some close calls, but it seems like they've wised up to that now. And the third thing is, on occasion, especially when the buzzards come back in the spring of the year and there's a lot of roadkill along the track bed, well, they'll be feeding on that. But what really surprised me one time, or actually more than once I've seen this, but the first time I saw it was an immature eagle with the mottled feather coloration right in the midst of six or eight buzzards that were down there just going to town on a piece of roadkill there along the track bed, and right in amongst them just feeding away right alongside.
Was the eagle.
Food is where you find it, and, you know, they're our national bird. They're beautiful and all that, but they are scavengers, among other things. So an easy meal's an easy meal.
There you go. And you got a fun job from the sound of it, Mike. Thank you for calling.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. That'd be kind of fun to
that is neat.
Be a railroad engineer along the, you know, and your run is along the Mississippi River. Yeah, fun place to, beautiful area for sure. We have more callers. Let's go to Barbara in Ocano next. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. Yeah, I'm calling because I have, it was just, I live in rural Ocano County, just outside of Oconto. And I go walking every day, and sometimes I have to walk when it's dark, so I wear a headlamp. And it was last winter. I step out of my driveway, and I see something like an orange glow in the distance. And it was just like one big splotch. And then as I got closer, you know, I could see that it was two eyes. And whatever it was, it followed me as I walked along. And I was just curious what animals' eyes glow dark, glow orange. Like this was very intense orange when light hits them.
Well, there may be, excuse me, there may be more than one because there are only so many colors in a lot of animals. But the one that I've seen around the house that's most distinctively orange, strikingly so, is an opossum.
But
the opossum's not very fleet of foot, and although it may have been going in the same direction, if you were walking at a brisk pace, I wouldn't expect an opossum to be able to keep up.
Oh, no, it was higher up off the ground than what, you know, something like a low creature, like a raccoon or a possum or whatever, and I just noticed the eyes following me. And I was just curious as to what it was because, I mean, you know, 10 miles or so north of us, there have been bear sightings. So I don't know. It wouldn't be a bear, would it?
Probably. To tell you the truth, I don't know. Someone who is maybe, for whatever reason, curiosity or otherwise, or lots of observations, seen more eye shine, most of it tends to be yellow or darker or whatever, not bright orange. The only other one I remember when we were in New Zealand doing possum control, that it was the blaze orange eyes that we had to look for. And the only advice we got from the supervisor this was, avoid anything with blue eyes. Sheep have blue eye shine. And they're the only animal that does. And they said, we're in New Zealand, don't mess with the sheep. But the possums were fair game for control reasons. But everything else was some other color. So I don't know. Maybe this is where we turn to the listeners and see what they've seen by way of animals that would be a little taller, from coyote to bear, and see what you come up with.
And so stay listening, Barbara, and thanks a lot for listening. Appreciate your call. Scott Craven, our guest wildlife ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along as we take a look at the world of wildlife today with wildlife ecologist Scott Craven. I'm Larry Mueller. Brianne Chasseau, our on-air producer today. Always great to have her at the phones. And so that's who you talk to when you call in. And that number to call, by the way, is 1-800-642-1234. Kevin in Madison has a question. Scott, and let's go there. Kevin, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. So a few days ago, my girlfriend had came back from taking the bus. She was walking down our street. And I noticed I thought it was just a German Shepherd. And when I looked closer, when she was getting nearer, realized it wasn't a German Shepherd. It was, after looking it up, it was a coyote. And I was just curious, why would a coyote be following? And also, what should we do? Because I haven't seen it, but I kind of am worried if that's something that I have to be worried
about. Yeah.
No, Kevin, I don't think so. I mean, we were talking about this a few minutes ago in relation to a similar sighting in Milwaukee, and it's not uncommon in most of our urban suburban areas where coyotes frequent everything from city parks to to green spaces, railroad corridors, bike trails, and in the absence of those, freely move through neighborhoods. And in part, the explanation is that it's simply part of their habitat. You know, one of my colleagues in the wildlife department here in Madison has been doing an urban carnivore study, working with foxes and coyotes and actually following radio-marked individuals around, and you might find that study pretty interesting. But also there's been a longer-term, very large study in the metro Chicago area done by a faculty member from Ohio State that has some amazing radio telemetry information that shows how these animals maneuver around the city, crossing busy roads, going from one green space to another, and really making the city their own at night in areas where the researchers wouldn't even go without police escorts. So the animals are incredibly adaptable. They're here. It's just that you were lucky enough. I say lucky enough. Some people would say unlucky enough to see one, because it may cause a little anxiety. But the reality is they're out there. And with the exception of concerns here in Madison, particularly on the west side, and there was some concern in other neighborhoods where the animals take pets, particularly small dogs and cats, that certainly causes a great deal of anxiety and concern for the pet owners or for other animal owners who are concerned about their pets. But in terms of a risk to human safety, it just has not materialized. So I think as a general warning, as we've talked about many times before in the program over the years, if you have small pets and you know there are coyotes around, and they're around just about everywhere, then manage your pets carefully in terms of their outdoor time, particularly at night, and everybody should get along just fine. So it's not something you should lose much sleep over, Kevin.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks.
Awesome. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Yep.
I just wanted to say really quick, thank you very much for this show. It has been very entertaining and very informational, and so I want to thank you both for the show you've been putting on today.
Well, thank you very much for that comment, Kevin, and thanks a lot for calling too. You and other callers kind of really helped make the show. Without you guys, we don't have a show. Well, we would. We'd sit and talk, but it wouldn't be as
interesting. Wouldn't be as good.
Wouldn't be as good, for sure. You know, Angela sent a note on Facebook and reminded, because we've been talking about coyotes and fox and stuff, that if you live in Dane County, people in Dane County should report sightings to the UW Urban Canid Project that you mentioned earlier, Scott. Mm-hmm. And they're asking people to report sightings. So if you go to online to the UW Urban Canid Project, that's going to pop up.
It should. And that's David Drake's study. And David's on in the alternate months that I am. So next time he's on, ask him to bring that up and emphasize the sighting issue. And so there's an opportunity for people who are making sightings like Kevin to contribute to the research project.
Yep, absolutely. Jim in Clinton up next. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
A few months ago, I heard your program. I'm a regular listener, and a lady from Delavan, Wisconsin, called and said that she noticed that she had several headless birds under her bird feeder. Well, where I live in Clinton, we live next to a woods, and I am a bird feeder. Keep my bird feeder well-stocked with sunflower seeds, especially. And we have a Cooper's hawk that frequents us, and when the Cooper's hawk comes, the birds scatter. When they scatter, we usually find a dead one or two that has hit the window. Well, 2 years ago, in that super cold winter that we had, I think they called it the Arctic...
Polar vortex,
yes. We had a Cooper's hawk that flew through, and a male cardinal hit the window and ended up dead on my deck. So it's because of the weather and so forth, and the ground frozen, I just kicked it off and off onto the snow. A few days later, I saw a squirrel outside that had come back to life in the cold of winter. And he picked up that bird, that cardinal, head up, and chewed the frozen head off the bird and left the rest of the bird. So I don't know if that was the experience that she was finding, but that's what I saw, and I was aghast very surprised that a squirrel would eat the head of a frozen bird and leave the rest. And it was so loud that you could actually hear the crunching inside the house.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry it's so close to lunchtime. But, well, so there's a couple interesting lessons from that, Jim. And one of them that's important is, you know, you find something dead, and people are, as several callers have, and they're always curious, oh, what happened to it? And it's often difficult to tease out what may have killed it from what may have modified the site after the fact.
Yeah.
And there are certainly plenty of animals that will kill these things, and there are some, like the weasels and horned owls we've talked about, that may remove the head immediately. But there are plenty of other things by way of scavengers, ranging from shrews, which are tiny little things all over the place, on up through the squirrels and on up the line, that may eat anything from the head to the whole animal over time. So it's difficult to separate some of that. Squirrels in general, if you were at all shocked about seeing a beloved gray squirrel that's just supposed to eat acorns do that, you could forget about that. Squirrels, given the opportunity, are opportunistic and quite carnivorous, particularly red squirrels and some of the ground squirrels. I've seen 13-line ground squirrels leap right up out of the grass. They look like a Polaris missile launching themselves to grab a fledgling bird that's struggling at, you know, a foot or two off the ground, grab it right out of the air, and then sit down and eat that. And there are other squirrels, too, that are important predators on ground-nesting birds. So don't be shocked by that, and realize that when you find something, you may not be able to tease out the whole story. But thank you for that, because it does add another element of explanation to some of these things people are finding.
Yeah, somebody else called a while back and said that they had observed a squirrel and some birds eating, you know, on the ground at their feeder. And suddenly the squirrel jumped on one of the birds and ate the bird. Caught the bird and ate it.
It's a tough life.
Wasn't happy about the seeds, apparently.
a tough life around a bird feeder, but...
Oh, man. Let's go to Dave in Madison on that note. Dave, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hey, this is David.
Yeah, what's on your mind?
Well, I just had a very surprising sight this winter, and getting back to it being on the mild side this year. I was surprised at Thanksgiving when I had seen the bluebirds were back. We have them all throughout the summer, maybe a couple of broods. But at Thanksgiving, I was a little surprised. But when I saw them Christmas, I was I just felt I would share that.
Wow, you saw them on Christmas, too.
Wow. It doesn't surprise me the way the fall went. A lot of birds hung around for a lot longer than they normally would. And bluebirds in particular can turn up even in a cold winter. There are sightings in January and February around here. I remember seeing a group of them in mid-February one year. But it's unusual, but it happens.
Yeah, it's cool. Yes. Cool sighting.
No mealyworms laid out or anything for them. They were just eating hackberries out of the hackberry tree. So
right, that's
really
what they
cool.
They usually turn to berries when the insect life is gone. So there you have
it. But I just thought it was quite interesting.
Oh, absolutely.
You made a Merry Christmas.
Yeah, did you take a picture?
I have several pictures.
Well, if you got a good one, put it up on our Facebook page.
Sure, I will do that.
I really would like that, Dave. Thank you very much. That'd be fun to have. Go to the Larry Mailer Show. That's the title of our Facebook page, and post right there. And Scott, you know, here we've been talking about bird feeders and bird feeding. your feeder's going well, and
it's been a very good season. Now, part of that's because I'm retired, so I'm home more during the day, and I can watch the feeders more closely. But as I've been watching, I've got a couple red-bellied woodpeckers, just beautiful birds.
And, yeah, they are.
You know,
pretty.
It occurred to me, for people who are maybe thinking about feeding, the experienced feeders know what I'm talking about. For those who are kind of on the edge, you know, you put a little seed out, and you can attract some spectacular birds. Their plumage is beautiful. Their activity is great. You get to know the personalities of some of the birds. My wife's moved toward feeding shelled peanuts to the blue jays.
Yeah.
Throw a handful out on the deck in the morning. There's not a blue jay to be seen, and within seconds, the whole family of four or five jays is there, and boom, the peanuts are gone. Just like that, in a heartbeat. And they're lugging them away and caching them somewhere. But it's fun to watch. The good news on the feeding is we're kind of moving into the peak of the season now. There'll be more opportunity. But bird feed prices are down. You know, I remember a few years ago we were talking about sunflower seed at $30 a bag for 50-pound bags. I've seen it on sale now for 15 or 16. So get some seed and give bird feeding a try.
It's a very, very good idea, especially this year with the prices that we've had. It'd be a great, if you haven't done it before, it's a great year to get started. And it's always great to have Scott Craven with us, and he's going to be with us today right up until 12:30. We'll take a quick look at the news and weather, and then we'll be back with Scott. You stay with us. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Lots of things going on in the outdoors these days, even in the middle of winter. You're always going to have some great wildlife experiences, and we're talking about those today with Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, UW Emeritus Professor, as a matter of fact. And he's been with us for a long, long time, the first Wednesdays of the month to come by to talk about wildlife. If you have a question or comment or experience to share, call us at 800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mehler Show. I'd love to hear from you. Barbara in Franklin has a question, or no, she has an experience to share, I believe. Hi, Barb.
Oh, hi, Larry and Scott.
Hello.
I live down in Franklin near the St. Martin's area. There's a big wooded area behind our house and then another clearing. Sitting in our sunroom 2 days ago, and a big turkey walked in front. My husband said, "Look at that turkey." And we got up, and lo and behold, coming from around the corner of our house, 30 more turkeys followed, like a little band of like an army. And they walked to the clearing where our neighbor puts corn and ate. It was comical how they just kept coming. And it was late in the day, and I said to my husband, "They're going to fly up in trees." I didn't imagine how high they'd fly. All of a sudden, one by one, they all flew up into the trees behind our house and really high. I never knew turkeys could fly that high. Mm-hmm. And they perched all night, and then the next morning when I was getting light, I went out on the deck and watched. They were all up there yet. One by one, they came down like little parachutes, and I was amazed there were so many of them. We counted like almost 30.
It's that time of year.
They're flocked together.
They're flocking together. The colder it gets, the more they'll flock together and generally gravitate to a good food source. They do roost in trees. They'll roost high in the trees. They look for big trees with horizontal limbs, and they just sit there all night and then fly down in the morning. So, I mean, you saw a good kind of a cross-section of turkey behavior. And if you've got them around and they've got food and water and good roost trees, they'll hang around for a while.
Okay. How many, I don't know, call them clutches, how many families, how many turkeys are in a family and then they all get together?
Well, excuse me. Well, they're all bunched up this time of year, but in general, you know, a brood it could be 11 or 12, but there's mortality throughout the year. So what you're seeing is probably a composite of 2, 3, 4, 5 families, probably 5, maybe even 6.
Oh.
But you could see much larger groups than that. It's not uncommon in southwestern Wisconsin to see big fields with groups of 150, 200.
Oh, really?
I remember when they were really abundant in years gone by, one of the turkey biologists described a valley out in the Driftless area somewhere. I don't remember where, but he said he parked the car and he looked up and down the valley and he could count 700 turkeys.
Oh!
So,
wow.
their numbers have fallen back a little bit, but it's, you know, seeing 20 or 30 at a time this time of year is pretty common.
Yeah.
And if you're in an area where there's a good dense turkey population, you could see hundreds.
And if you're like my good friends Denny and Carol Moore, who feed birds, and they get a little, Denny gets a little perturbed from time to time because the turkeys will come in and scare off the other birds and just sit there and eat all of his seed that he just put out, and they'll eat it all up.
Well, they're birds, too.
I saw three of them. I'm going to guess they were the male turkey. They were kind of fighting with each other, chasing, a couple were chasing another away, so I don't know if they do that, too.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes the hens will chase each other around, too, but the males are easy to identify with that big beard hanging down. So if you see a beard, you know that's a gobbler.
Kind of right out of their chest. It's a tuft of hair, I guess you'd call it.
Well, they're feathers, but it looks like an old shaving cream brush.
Yeah.
And
okay.
Dangles right out of the breast, and on a big old gobbler, it might be 10 or 11 inches long, almost.
Yeah.
The hunters call them long beards, and the beard almost drags on the ground, but it will be very conspicuous.
Okay, I'll watch for that tonight.
Okay.
All right, good enough. And if you, if you get a good picture, a photo, Barbara, put it up on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. I would love to see that. 30 turkeys up in a tree in the back lawn. That'd be pretty cool. Mike in Castle Rock has something for us. Mike, hi. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. A couple of questions. I wondered if anybody has seen the northern shrike yet. I usually get them this time of the year, and I wondered if anybody had spotted any. Secondly, there seems to be a decline in cardinals here. In where I live, it was not unusual for me to have in the evening 20 cardinals.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I only see one or two, and I wondered if anybody had any comments on that.
Well, we can turn to the callers. Turn to the listeners rather. I've only seen one shrike in my yard in the last, in the 15 years or so we've lived there, and I've not seen one recently. But again, if other people have made shrike sightings, they can call in. As far as the cardinals are concerned, I think the most likely explanation, Mike, is just that it's been such an open year that the cardinals haven't been very dependent on the feeders. But my feeding station, like yours and like most, is cardinals generally come in very late in the day. Sometimes it's almost dark, and you can just see the silhouette of a cardinal still pecking away. But like you, whereas last winter, some afternoons I could count 15 or more cardinals on the four or five feeders. If I have a pair now, that's been about the daily average. So I haven't looked at that as any type of a calamity yet, because I'm guessing as we get a little more normal winter weather, there'll be more cardinals around.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you very much for calling, Mike. Appreciate your call. And we have other callers. Let's go to Phil in Wanakee. Hi, Phil.
Oh, good morning, or afternoon now.
Yeah.
I enjoy your program. I had a question about the, I live in Wanakee, right in the middle of the town, and I had a pair of fox that I've seen occasionally this fall, and there they were Sunday morning, and they sat in the backyard for the whole morning, all curled up, and then they got up, caught themselves a couple of voles, and then headed out across the neighbor's yards. And my question was, are they in the middle of breeding season now? It seems like they're kind of frisky looking.
It's a little early yet, but a lot of those things will be getting underway here over the next few weeks. The eagles will start breeding activity. Foxes won't be far behind. The horned owls will be active by the end of the month. So, yeah, we're heading into that time, and maybe this was just a pair that was kind of
early
on
the
near edge of the bell curve of breeding activity.
Uh-huh.
But it's still a little bit early, but not far away.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and could you read, I just caught the beginning of your show before when you were just talking about the UW Extension and they'd like to have people let them know about sightings of fox and coyotes and stuff. And
yeah,
I could do that also. Could you repeat that? Where am I supposed to go on my website?
Sure thing.
Well, it's the project is called the Urban Canid Project. Canid, the family name for the dog family, fox and coyotes and whatnot. So C-N-I-C-N-C-A-N-I-D. And okay. I think if you just Google search that, it'll come up. But the person to contact, if you're having trouble with it, the supervisor of the project is a colleague of mine in the department. His name is David Drake, D-R-A-K-E. And through the university directory, you can get right to David or to his project.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if there's a link through the university website, too. But
yeah,
I just don't know right now.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks a lot. And I'm sure they would be most interested, especially fox.
Mm-hmm.
Coyotes, they're more, apparently.
I don't know if they're still capturing animals or not, but usually if there's been animals around that are very reliable in terms of their location, they may even try and mark them. I don't know.
Doug in Verona, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having my call. I just built a house out there in Verona not too long ago, and we always put a fake tree on our porch in the wintertime, you know, at Christmas time. And in years past, in our other home, I would put a suet cage underneath on one of the lower limbs, and it would attract birds, and we'd get a number of men to it at the other house. But in this subdivision where I live, I'm one lot away from kind of the edge and where it's agricultural and natural area, but I don't see any birds hardly ever around any time of the year, it seems, at least anything that's, and I suspect it might be because, you know, the landscaping is not that exciting and it's new. And but I was just wondering, when I put this suet out, you know, in this new subdivision, I didn't get any activity. I'm just wondering how I can attract birds when I seem to be challenged a bit by that.
Well, a couple of suggestions, Doug. One is have some patience in a new subdivision or a new home where the landscaping is very young. There isn't a lot of cover, and there's a couple things going on. A, you don't have the cover. By choosing suet, you were restricting yourself primarily to the woodpeckers, nuthatches, and, you know, maybe chickadees, a few other birds that will use the suet, but also are really tuned into trees. So my suggestion would be out in the open a little more, spread some seed, some sunflower seed, black oil sunflower spread on the snow, or a feeder out in the open near whatever you have for a shrub, or use a couple old Christmas trees that you salvage and erect those near a feeder. I think you'll start to get some birds, and over time, as the landscaping matures and there's more cover, you'll get more and more birds. And as you say, you're one or two lots removed from the habitat they're probably using. You may be one or two lots removed from someone who has an established feeding station, too, that's attracting most of their interest now. But I think if you're persistent, try a few different foods, try a different location, you'll get some birds eventually. Don't give up.
Don't give up.
Oh, okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. I just went to our Facebook page here while you were talking, Scott, and a lot of photos up. We've got a hawk of some sort. Let's see. I can't tell for sure.
I can't tell without getting up here. It looks like a Cooper's hawk, though.
Yeah.
I don't have a frame or see the banded tail. So without the frame of reference, Cooper's sharp shinned, but it looks
like a Cooper's to me.
Feeder pole. It looks like a Cooper's.
And here we got an eagle.
There's an eagle feeding on a deer carcass, looks like.
Yeah, and let's see if we got anything else. Oh,
there's Mr. Turkey.
We have a video of a turkey, which I can't get going here for some reason, but apparently the turkey's been trying to get through the window.
Pecking on the window.
Pecking on the window to get in. And so that's a Tom. You can see the beard. So
there you go. Huh.
Yeah, so that's pretty cool. Thanks for those photos, and you know, we always love photos, so send more. Go to the Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of our Facebook page. We have Jen in Mattawa. Is it Minnesota?
Yep, you said that right, Larry.
Thank you, Jen, for calling.
Yeah, thank you for the great show again. So about 13 years ago or so, we moved here to Mattawa, which is a little ways south of Duluth. It's a farming community, and we do have farms within a mile of us. We moved here from a place that was about an hour or so north of Duluth, and at that home, we were adjacent to 2,000 acres of state forest land, and we would go through about 50 pounds of black oil sunflower seeds a week, and we had just such an array of absolutely gorgeous, colorful songbirds. We would have, you know, during the wintertime, we'd have the beautiful bright red pine grosbeaks, and we had the black and yellow evening grosbeaks. And in the summer, we'd put out food right during the nesting season, and we'd have the blue jays bring their babies and feed them. And it was not unusual to see 40 or 50 of those. And then we had all the usuals, you know, the chickadees and juncos and nuthatches and whatnot. But here in Mattawa, we have been trying so hard to draw the birds in, and all we can get here are the starlings by the, you know, hundreds, and we get some pigeons from the local farm who, they don't feed them. I'm not sure why the pigeons are hanging around so much, but they do. And so I'm wondering, you know, do you think that the starlings and the pigeons are just keeping the songbirds out, or are the songbird populations just hurting so much now from, you know, various reasons, or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it sounds like when you were north of Duluth, you were in an ideal setting with that much habitat nearby, and maybe being kind of the only game in town as far as a feeding station. To have the pine grosbeaks in particular, evening grosbeaks are kind of, they wander all over the place. You may have them, you may not, but I mean, there was a couple of birds, particularly the evening grosbeaks. A flock of evening grosbeaks can really go through the sunflower seeds. So, you know, that you were going through a lot of seed, and grosbeaks are a prime consumer. But you had terrific habitat nearby. Where you are now, it sounds like being closer to farms, you've got some birds in the form of pigeons and starlings that most folks don't consider very desirable around the feeder.
Yeah.
Starlings can be pretty aggressive. Pigeons, not so much. But generally speaking, unstable, suspended feeders are a little less attractive to pigeons. The starlings may move on, or if you can find out what they're using as a, you know, if there's an agricultural barn or pole building or livestock operation nearby, maybe you can convince them they don't want the starlings around either and have some options. But I think that the explanation for your current paucity of birds does not lie with there's no birds. It lies with your setting and opportunity, and you're just greatly compromised from what you had before. So, you know, try and improve the cover over time. Try a few different feeder designs and see what happens as winter begins to finally engulf us, although up there I think it's been winter for a while. And see what happens. But I think you're victimized by location more than anything else.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. I just went back to Facebook here, and there's Trin sent a photo. She said, my mom asked me to share this photo she took during her mail route near Hammond, Wisconsin, a beautiful snowy owl, and not very high up.
No, and not in the most pristine setting either, sitting on an electrical transformer, but they like open spaces like that. I'm glad the picture came up because I wanted to mention that this is another year that there seem to be lots of snowy owls moving down again. So keep your eyes open. They're spectacular, and they've attracted an awful lot of attention across the northern tier of states in the last few years. So
a couple of weeks ago, we were, and I mentioned this on the show before, but a couple of weeks ago, people on the seventh floor of Vilas Hall, where we are right now, looked out the window to the east, and there was a snowy owl up on the rooftop of the building next door.
Well, keep your
the
eyes
lucky building.
Keep your eyes out for them, and if you're you know, if you're not seeing something outside the window, don't hesitate to turn to the computer, because this is the time of year. Lots of the wildlife cameras that are positioned around the country capturing things like the nesting eagles in Decorah start to get up and running, and you can sit there at the comfort of your home and watch what's going on through computer links as well.
And that Decorah site...
Very popular.
Very, very popular. Yeah. It's absolutely amazing. Sylvia in Appleton has something for us. Hi, Sylvia.
Hi. A quick comment on the starlings.
Yeah.
They are extremely aggressive. Mm-hmm. They will keep the other birds away. And years ago, I had to intervene to keep a starling from almost literally killing a flicker. And I wanted to comment on the shrikes. They were seen to the gentleman back in November already, but their sightings have been very few, along with the rough-legged hawks for some reason this mm-hmm. year. Cardinals, I have 8 males and 3 females coming daily, and as Scott said, often very late in the day.
Yeah.
However, a couple years ago, I had a male. He kept all the other cardinals except one female out of my yard for several years. He would aggressively chase anything. So I was very happy this year. He must have expired or left someplace. And
he went to the big seed feeder in the sky.
So it's been very nice watching these guys. But I have, unfortunately, huge amount of sparrows, house sparrows. And it's kind of hard to keep all the food out for the cardinals.
Well, it's difficult. If you're beset by, this isn't the time of year when grackles are a problem. In the spring, they're a problem for me. I don't have starlings, very many house sparrows, and certainly not pigeons. But those are the three, starlings, pigeons, and house sparrows, that are essentially unprotected by law. So, I mean, it is possible to be a bit more aggressive in their management, but most people don't want to do that. So sometimes you can take steps to change the habitat or the surroundings a bit, or use a different feed and minimize that. But of the three, starlings are probably the biggest problem. So thanks for your insights.
Yeah,
appreciate
the call. Sparrows have been on a bit of a decline due to other birds.
The house finches.
House finches have been sort of beating them out a bit, and so they're in decline. But I tell you what, there's still a lot of them at my feeders.
Plenty of them.
Mostly, anytime I look out, if I'm going to see a bird, probably 7 out of 8 times it's going to be a house sparrow in there among the whatever's there.
I had a flock of red poles day before yesterday, which is pretty unusual for me, so that was kind of neat. But that's the thing about bird feeding. You just don't know what you're going to see.
You never know. Scott, we do know that you're going to be back.
I will be back, I guess, in March, I think.
March. Yep. March up next. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, will be back on the first Wednesday of March. And looking forward, David Drake and Jamie Knack will be back with us the first Wednesday of February. So they're coming back as well. And it's always a lot of fun, isn't it? Oh, I always enjoy these shows on wildlife. And I'm sorry we didn't get to everybody, but that's always the way it works. Tomorrow at 11, we'll learn about antiques and what they might be worth. If you got something in your attic that you want to have checked out, Shirley Bauman is the person to talk to, and she will be with me tomorrow. In the meantime, thanks for listening and stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.